almost were there. It's in the back. So Muhammad would get these visions. He would be able to see into hell and be able to see into paradise. And one time he looked in there and he says, look, most of the people in hell are women. He says, so you'd better be good. You've got a lot to overcome. And they asked, well, why is that? And he says, because I have never seen anyone more deficient in intelligence and in religion than you women. Okay, we're getting close. It's just a little dark. Oh, okay. Okay, well, let's try the next slide. Why are they deficient in intelligence? There we go. He said, is not the evidence of two women equal to the witness of one man? They replied in the affirmative. He says, well, this is the deficiency in her intelligence. It was a cultural standard, and the Jews had it too. It took two women to equal the testimony of one man. But Muhammad is spinning this into evidence that of why. And he's saying, well, it's because you're so stupid. I mean, it's just like you got half a brain. It takes two of you to equal the testimony of one man. Because he's touching in terms of intelligence, right? Okay, well, now what about... So he's taking a cultural standard and he's spinning it into this whole business about women being inferior intellectually. Now let's see why they are deficient in religion. Next slide, please. It said, isn't it true that a woman can neither pray nor fast during her menses? And the woman replied in the affirmative. He said, this is the deficiency in her religion. So again, it was a cultural standard that women were not allowed to participate in the prayers and the fasting if they were having their period. Why? I don't know. Maybe it's just, you know, there's a bit mess there sometimes. It could be. It was a little unpleasant, so they just said, no, go over there. But now he's spinning it into evidence that, well, this you're just deficient spiritually. You're not as good. You might as well just say, well, if you have facial hair, then you can't fast and you can't pray, and therefore you're deficient. Sorry, Pastor. It's just an example, okay? I'm not serious, but something that's characteristic of men. It's just like picking something and say, well, because of that, you're inferior. Does that make sense? Well, it did to Muslims, and it does to Muhammad. Next slide, please. The vileness of women is so great that it can even cancel out the power of prayer. Aisha, the little girl he married at 6, who alleged to be his favorite wife, she spent a lot of time with Muhammad, so she got a lot of his insights. Well, here is one of them. The things which annul or cancel out the prayers were mentioned before me. They said prayer is annulled by a dog, a donkey, and a woman if they pass in front of the praying people. Now, first of all, Muhammad did not like dogs. He said more than once, if you have a dog and not for work purposes, in other words, as a pet, you're going to lose a half, I think it was like a karat or something. Basically, think about it, you're going to lose a half quart of credit every day if you have a dog. He didn't like dogs. In another place, he ordered kill all the dogs. So obviously, he doesn't think very highly of dogs, and donkeys are usually not regarded very highly. So look, at Muhammad puts them in the same category as women. Now, remember the Qibla? That's the direction you pray, and oftentimes in a mosque or a Muslim home, there'll be a mark or a plaque or something on the wall, so you face in the proper direction you're supposed to face Mecca. Okay, so say you're there and you're praying, and you're down in the proper position, and you're doing everything right, and you're getting all the points, that you're ding, 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 you know, the points are just racking up there, but then a dog walks and intercepts your Qibla. Oh, there, no points for you. A donkey walks in front. No points for you. I'm down there. I'm praying. I'm getting on. Ding, 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 ding. And then a woman walks in front and intersects my Qibla. No points. Zeroed out. And this is interesting, especially in today's context. If you would have the next slide, please. He also believed that women make poor leaders. During the Battle of Al-Jamal, Muhammad heard the news that the people of Persia had made the daughter of Khosrau their ruler. On this, he said, a nation which makes a woman their ruler will never succeed. I can't help but think that Hillary Clinton takes money from these people. Well, there's something about women. Let's look at now Jews and Christians, first Jews. So if we have the next slide, please. As you study through this, and this is one of the tough things, when you say, if you just start off like I did, read the Quran, it's just like, what's going on here? There was this strange bipolar love-hate relationship with Jews. And we'll see in a little bit that it's because of the difference between the Meccan and the Medinan period, from when he was Meccan and when he was Medina. It started off very, very positive toward the Jews. Let's look at a few examples. Next slide, please. It says, indeed, we, this is Allah speaking because it's from the Quran, we gave the children of Israel the book, the judgment, and the prophethood, and we provided them with good things, and we preferred them above all beings. I read that and I thought, wow, hey, there's a chance for hope here. Let's look at another one. We gave to Moses, whom we called Musa, the book and the salvation. Okay, that's pretty powerful stuff. Next, children of Israel, remember my blessing wherewith I blessed you, and that I have preferred you above all beings. There it is again. Wow, that sounds hopeful. Until, I'll turn a few more pages and look at something else. Next slide, please. The divine revelations that Muhammad had about the Jews changed drastically once he moved to Medina, and we'll see why here in a little bit. The Jews went from preferred by Allah to abhorred by him. Let's see a few examples. Next slide, please. Muhammad said, God has cursed them for their unbelief and only a few will believe. Elsewhere, he said, the apostle said, kill any Jew that falls into your power. Any Jew. Not if they're guilty of a crime, not if they're fighting against you, any Jew, any circumstance. In fact, if I were to read that whole story to you, and it is recorded in the book, when he said that, there was a Muslim there, and he heard this, and he immediately left and went out and killed a Jew that his family knew. Killed him. His brother said, what are you doing? This guy has been so nice to our family. He's been very generous to our family. He's given us all kinds of good things. What are you doing? Are you nuts? And he says, Muhammad said, kill any Jew that comes into your power. And the brother said, as you might think, if Muhammad told you to kill me, would you do that too? And he answered, yes. Now, you think the brother might be offended, but to just show you this weird mindset, the brother said, wow, any religion that can do something like that is magnificent. That's the kind of mindset we're dealing with here. Remember, kill any Jew that falls into your power. Next, please. Once the prophet went out after sunset and heard a dreadful voice and said, the Jews are being punished in their graves. And elsewhere he said, a tribe of Jews disappeared. I do not know what became of them, but I think they changed and became rats. And even in the Quran, he refers to the Jews as apes. Not Jews are apes. But you see him talking about them, and he talks about apes, and you see there's a definite link there. So something happened. We'll get to that in just a minute. But let's go to the next slide. We'll see the same... Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, the next one. That was my fault. We see the same kind of bipolar love-hate relationship with Christians. Okay, if we have the next slide. And we gave to Moses the book, and after him sent succeeding messengers. And we gave Jesus, whom they called Isa, son of Mary, who they call Miriam, the clear signs and confirmed him with the Holy Spirit. Wow, that sounds pretty good. Yes. And there's many other references to Jesus in the Quran, and they are basically positive. He's referred to as the Messiah. But remember, Messiah does not mean son of God. It means anointed one. So really, any prophet is kind of like a small M Messiah. He was a great prophet, a great teacher. But, next slide, please. He wasn't God's son. He wasn't divine. There is no Trinity. There was no crucifixion. There was no resurrection. So there is no salvation through him. That pretty well wipes out the whole foundation of Christianity, doesn't it? Let's see the next slide, please. The Messiah, here again, Messiah, Jesus, son of Mary, was only the messenger of God. So believe in God and his messengers, notice the plural, and say not three, here they're referring to the Trinity. Refrain, better is it for you, God is only one God. A couple important things there. You know, he's not divine, and he's one of many messengers. Again, look at the plural here, look at this S. yeah, he's a prophet. He's a great prophet, just like all the other great prophets. So you could imagine that if the prophets took a team picture and they're all standing there, Jesus would be second row, third one in from the right, you know? Just like in his shining face there, just like with all the rest of them. Reduced to all the rest of the prophets. But here again, with that repetition we've seen over and over and over again. Let's see the next slide. We'll see how he attacked Jesus. They are unbelievers who say God is the Messiah, Mary's son. Remember what I said a little while ago? God loveth not the unbelievers. So guess where they're going? Not paradise. But if you say the Messiah is God, God is the Messiah, you are an unbeliever, you're going to hell. And next, God has not taken to himself any son. You see that over and over and over again. So how do we account for all this stuff about the crucifixion and the resurrection? Next slide. The Quran says, they did not slay him, neither crucified him, only a likeness of that was shown to them. So in other words, the crucifixion and the resurrection was just kind of like a mass hallucination that several people saw together. Like if a vision suddenly popped up, you know, we all saw it together. He believed that Jesus never did die, that like Enoch and Elijah, he was swept up into heaven. And he will come back, but to institute Sharia law. Okay? So, let's see the practical effect of all this in the next slide, please. Basically, Muhammad condemned Jesus with false praise by saying, yeah, he's a great prophet, but then attempted to gut the whole salvation message of Christianity by denying Christ's divinity, death, and resurrection. How diabolically clever is that? And where does the word diabolical come from? Diablo, the devil. Satan knows he can't take God on head to head, like two sumo wrestlers crashing together. It's like you got the sumo wrestler and this 98-pound weakling, right? Boom, he bounces him right out of the ring. He's got to attack God through some kind of envelopment. Some kind of sideways attack. He can't do it head on. And so he comes on and says, yeah, Jesus, oh yes, he's a wonderful guy. We love Jesus. He's a great teacher. Oh, but... And then they deny all the things that we believe in as the only route to salvation. And think how many people buy into that and what happens to them. Satan wins. How diabolically clever. Another thing you need to know. Next slide, please. Muhammad condemned Christians as polytheists, means many gods, somebody who believes in multiple gods. Now, we aren't the only polytheists, but we are polytheists in their opinion because we believe in Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. To him, that's three gods, not one God and three persons. You need to know that because of the references that you'll sometimes see to polytheists. For example, the next slide, Muhammad declared, kill the polytheists wherever you find them. Does that sound familiar? Like kill any Jew that falls into your power? Kill the polytheists wherever you find them and seize them and besiege them and lie in wait for them in every ambush. But if they repent and perform the prayer and pay the poor tax, let them go their way. God is forgiving and merciful. Kill the Jews. Kill the polytheists. That's pretty much the Muslim answer to every problem. Kill it. Kill it. Stamp it out. Kill it. We see it over and over again. Okay, now let's go back to that question. Next slide, please. That I raised before. Why a love-hate relationship with Jews and Christians? Why not just a hate relationship? I mean, that's pretty standard for people, you know. If you don't like somebody, you say, I hate you. You don't say, I love you and I hate you. What's the deal with that? That seems kind of strange. Well, let's see the next slide here and explain this. In Mecca, remember the first phase, Muhammad had linked himself with the succession of biblical prophets. He claimed to be validated by this heritage, and he couldn't abandon it. Now, in Mecca, there were almost no Christians and Jews, so there's nobody there to contest it when he said, I am the last link in this chain of prophets. There was nobody to contest it. He got away with it. And that's how he validated himself, and that's where he got his authority. He couldn't deny it later on. That pulled the rug right out from under his own feet. When he was chased off to Medina, though, now he's in a community where there are a number of Christians and Jews, and he started to tell his tales, and they said, whoa, Mo, time out. That's not how the story goes. And you'll, if you read the Koran, you'll see certain biblical stories. And I've read the Bible many times. I've read many different translations, many of them multiple times. And I'm reading there and saying, wait a minute. I don't remember it going like that. No, basically what Muhammad said was, the word that Moses gave and the other prophets and the word that Jesus gave in the gospel was perverted by the church leaders at the time because it didn't serve their ends. So when you go to a Bible bookstore and you buy a copy of the Bible, that's not the real Bible. That's been perverted. If you want to know what the real Bible says, you have to listen to Muhammad. Remember I said it's all about him? Even what the Bible says comes from him, according to them. So he couldn't throw away this tradition because he rooted himself into it. He wove himself into the tapestry of the Judeo-Christian prophetic history. He couldn't pull himself out of it now without destroying his authority. So when he was in Mecca, he had all these nice sayings because he's trying to build that up because it builds him up. But then when he goes to Medina, so that's the love part. Let's see the next slide, though, please. When he goes to Medina, there were Christians and Jews who challenged them. They had to be countered. Now they became the bad guys. Oh, you're believing in lies. And there's the hate part. Now, if you are a kafir, one of us, the deniers, the infidels, the non-believers, it's important for you to understand your options. I talked about this before, but now we're going to really hammer it home and give you the documentation for it. Next slide, please. The only options for kafirs are to convert, become Muslim, be enslaved, or die. That's it. Convert, be enslaved, or die. Remember those three options. That's it. Why aren't they doing it here? Because they're too weak to pull it off. But that's what's coming. If they're allowed to grow in numbers, that is what's coming. It's been happening for 14 centuries. You can bet on it. Now, where's the documentation for this? Next slide, please. There's a famous verse in the Quran, so famous that it even has a name. It's called the verse of the sword. It's 9:5. And I'm going to give it to you, and then I'm going to translate, because again, a lot of the stuff in the Quran is very flowery, kind of hard to follow. Then when the sacred months are drawn away, there's four sacred months, and you're supposed to cool it with all the killing and fighting, although again, Muhammad got this divine download that allowed him to do it. When the sacred months are drawn away, slay the idolaters wherever you find them and take them and confine them and lie in wait for them at every place of ambush. But if they repent, perform the prayers, and pay the alms, then let them go their way. God is all-forgiving, all-compassionate. Okay, let's translate this. Let's show you, embedded in this is the convert, be enslaved, or die. And Muhammad repeated it again over and over and over again. So if we have the next slide, please. Watch what turns to red. The next slide? Is that the next slide? Oh, sadly, it turned to just a slightly lighter shade. Lost something in the translation. Okay, I'll point it out. In the back, you can see it. Okay, let's start at the bottom, work our way up. Repent, perform the prayer, pay the alms. That's convert. Those are the things, part of the five pillars. Okay, if you do these things, if you become a Muslim, then let them go their way. Okay, that's the convert part. Go up a little bit. Confine them. That's the enslave part. Or slay them. That's the kill part. Convert, be enslaved, or die. Those are the only options offered to you. Well, that's the theory. That's the teachings. Those are the documents. Let's see a little bit of the history now and see if Muhammad's Muslims followed up on that. Next slide, please. Violent aggression has been a part of Islamic foreign policy from the very beginning. Islam did not expand because it had an appealing ideology. It expanded because it had a ruthless army that was willing to commit any type of atrocity in order to further its ends. That's how it grew. Next slide, please. The first victims were the various communities within the territory of modern-day Saudi Arabia. But even before Muhammad's death in 632, Islamic expansion had reached beyond the Arabian Peninsula. Now, I want you to remember something. 632, that's when he died, 632. Through his life, remember all of those raids that he began? He had already gone from nothing in Medina to taking over pretty much the whole Arabian Peninsula and started to reach out beyond it. That's already a tremendous amount just in his lifetime. Watch how quickly it advances after that. Remember 632. Next slide, please. Gaza. You know the Gaza Strip? You probably heard about that. That's where the Philistines lived. That's like in the southwest portion of Israel by the Mediterranean. Gaza was sacked 634, 2 years after Muhammad's death. 635, the major Syrian city of Damascus fell. Huge importance. Next, al-Basra in Iraq fell, 636. And then Antioch, remember the book of Acts? And Jerusalem, Old Testament and New Testament, were taken just 6 years after Muhammad died. 10 years after, in November of 642, Alexandria fell, of huge importance. This Egyptian city, of huge cultural, economic, political importance. Next slide, please. 80 years after the death of Muhammad, he's already swept across North Africa and moved across Gibraltar into Spain. It would not be until 1492 that the Spaniards finally expelled the Muslim hordes from their land. That's almost 800 years the Muslims dominated Spain. At 1492, probably familiar to you, in 1492, Columbus sailed the ocean blue. There's no coincidence there. Christopher Columbus had presented his plan to go to the east by sailing to the west years before, but King Ferdinand and Queen Isabella were a little tied up at the time. Why? They were fighting the Muslim hordes. It wasn't until 1492 that finally wrapped up. It was a few months after that they said, okay, Chris, go ahead, go for it. Next slide, please. Now they pushed through Spain into France just 90 years after the death of Muhammad. In 846, the Islamic forces reached Rome and bullied a promise of tribute from the Pope. Now the Pope is paying tribute to the Muslims. And yet it would be another 2.5 centuries before the Christians answered the call to fight back and commissioned the First Crusade. We'll talk more about that in a bit. Next slide, please. So that's going into the West. They also swept into the East, advancing into present-day Afghanistan, Pakistan, and India. 3 continents were under siege: Asia, Africa, Europe. Huge swath of land. And hundreds of battles had been fought in this period of time. And the Christians basically sat there and took it. And millions of them were killed. Others were enslaved. Let's have the next slide, please. It was not until 1095, do the math, 633 to 1095, over 4.5 centuries, Christians did basically nothing until finally the Pope Urban II commissioned the first of the Crusades, which wasn't launched until 1098. 4.5 centuries. So people out there saying, well, you were bad because of the Crusades and all that stuff. Yeah, the Muslims fought literally several hundred battles during those 450 years, and we did almost nothing. We responded with, as you'll see here, 7 crusades over a period of about 1.5 centuries and fought dozens of battles. You want to compare that? And it says down here, the Muslim assaults soared to several hundred over many centuries. Okay, next slide, please. Most of the accomplishments of the Crusades were subsequently lost. But they did succeed in pushing back the Islamic lines and slowing down their sweep across 3 continents. So it kind of slowed them down a little bit. Now, one of the things here that you'll hear, even by high-ranking government officials, is that, well, yes, the Muslims did do some bad things, but you have your Crusades, you know, and they did some bad things as well. Yeah, they did. Atrocities were committed on both sides. I think this is a very important thing to remember about that, though. When the Christians committed atrocities, they did it in violation of their beliefs. When the Muslims committed atrocities, they did it in accord with their beliefs. It's a huge difference, don't you think? Next slide, please. The relentless surge continued. They had been pushed back and delayed a little bit, but then after the last of the Crusades, they started pushing back again. More territory fell to the Muslim armies over the following centuries. Now they concentrated on the eastern Mediterranean area going up the Balkans. Greece, Bulgaria, Serbia, Macedonia, Albania, Croatia all fell. And then came Constantinople. Huge. This is like the eastern axis of the Christian community. Rome and Constantinople, named after Constantine, the first Roman emperor who adopted Christianity. That was in 1453. Well, they're now pushing up this way. They're heading right to the heart of Central Europe, Vienna. A huge metropolitan area of great importance politically, economically, socially, culturally. They're threatening Vienna. They launch an attack. It gets held up. They manage to stop it. They're gearing up for their second attack when, next slide please, the Polish king, John III Sobieski, came down from Poland and organized the attack that thwarted the Muslims during their second assault on Vienna. It was so devastating. It was such a blow to them that now they get knocked back on their heels and he starts pushing them back the way they had come. It marked the high tide of Islamic expansion in Europe, at least so far, and the beginning of their retreat. But there's something very, very important about when this happened. This battle, the second attack on Vienna. Next slide, please. I think you'll get the drift of it here immediately. The date of the battle was September the 11th, 1683. Two important things. This is over 1,000 years since the death of Muhammad. This has been going on. Relentless assault, aggression, murder, enslavement, rape, pillage, on and on and on. The other thing, of course, is September 11th. September 11th, or 9/11, has symbolized a vow of vengeance for the defeat of Vienna. This has been going on for centuries now. Anybody, and especially any administration, a non-Muslim administration that does not understand the significance of 9/11 is not doing a very good job of protecting its people. You must anticipate that the Muslims are going to do something around, on or around that date. That is their date of vengeance. Next slide, please. Now, in addition to savage aggression, the history of Islam has been characterized by another atrocity. Next slide. Slavery. Now remember, Muhammad was the model Muslim. Let's see the next slide, please. He was involved in virtually every aspect of slavery. Ransoming prisoners and selling slaves were among the first profit centers of Islam and were used by Muhammad to finance his jihad. When I say almost every aspect of slavery, let's get specific. What was he involved in? Next slide. Muhammad owned several slaves, including black slaves, who, by the way, didn't fetch as high a price as the white slaves. You want to talk about bigotry? There it goes. He was a slave trader. He enslaved the women and children of many conquered settlements. He kept sex slaves for his own pleasure. Next slide, please. Now, regarding those sex slaves, his only son came through one of those sex slaves, so it wasn't officially part of his line. Muhammad gave slaves as gifts, just like a box of candy. Here, take that slave. He passed around slaves for the sexual gratification of his closest associates, who were known as his companions. He also approved of slave owners raping their female slaves. The only compunction they had about this is, you know, if you get them pregnant, they're not worth as much. Not worth as much if they have to take care of a kid. Next slide, please. Islam also played a critical role in the slave trade that sent most of the African slaves to America. Muslims ran slave markets along the west coast of Africa, much like someone would set up a produce stand. Now, thanks to the corrupt education and entertainment industry, we have this notion of white men in wooden ships sailing off the west coast of Africa and disgorging raiding parties to go and kidnap the natives of this area, chaining them up, stuffing them back in these ships, and coming back either to Europe or to America and sell them into slavery. And tragically, a lot of that is true. But the part that is not so true is disgorging the raiding parties to capture these people. They didn't have to. The Muslims had already set up slave markets along the West Coast. Remember that 120 million number of Africans who were killed? Millions more were enslaved. Remember the options? Convert, be enslaved, or die. Here's a classic example. Many of the Africans would not convert, so they were enslaved or killed. And when they were enslaved, they set up these markets and started to sell them just like at a produce stand. Next slide, please. It has been estimated that about 25 million Africans have been sold as slaves by Muslim slave traders. Roughly 11 million of them were sold in the Americas. And tragically, this grisly business continues into today. But there was another aspect of slavery, a kind of very creative, again, diabolically creative twist that Muhammad came up with on the slave trade. And that is, next slide, dhimmitude. What the heck is that? Dhimmitude. Next slide, please. In 629, Muhammad attacked the Jewish settlement of Kaibar. Now, this is not Bani Qurayza. This is another one. It's about 93 miles from Medina. When the defeat of the Jews seemed imminent, the Jews of Kaibar suggested terms of surrender that were simply irresistible to Muhammad the merchant. See, I remember I said something that changed was he stopped killing everybody because there's no money to be made in a corpse. So he started holding them for ransom or selling them into slavery. Well, next slide. Muhammad would allow the Jews to live and stay on their land if they would surrender half of their produce to him every year. Muhammad agreed, and the institution, I mean, this is what was proposed, and Muhammad agreed, and the institution of dhimmitude was born. So if you capture someone, you can only sell them once. You can only make money off them once. If you let them live, and they promise to give you half of their earnings every year, you keep making money over and over and over and over in perpetuity. And this would become a major tool of the Muslims in the conquered areas. Let's understand this term, dhimmitude, a little bit more. Next slide, please. It's from an Arabic word, dhamith, which means both protected and guilty. Now, how does it mean both those things? It means protected because they are part of, there's a contract, there's a contractual agreement here. And we'll talk about some of the terms of that contract. But they're guilty because they haven't submitted to Allah. Remember, Islam means submission. So they haven't submitted yet. They haven't done that main thing. So let's see some of the terms of the agreement here. Next slide, please. The Jews of Kaibar were very successful farmers. Muhammad didn't know anything about farming. So the Jews cleverly said, hey, it didn't go too well for Bani Qurayza. Let's see if we can't figure out something else. So they said, look, if you let us live and you let us continue to be Jews, we'll give you half of what we have now or half of what we make every year. Muhammad says, okie doke. He says, you're not a good farmer. This is farmland. You're not going to do anything with it. We'll make you rich. Now, here's some of the terms of the contract. The demise do not have to convert, but they do surrender about half of, up to half of their wealth, which is called the jizya tax. They may be publicly humiliated. In fact, a lot of times when they surrendered this tax, it was done in public, and when they would come up and surrender this money, they'd be slapped, they'd be beaten, you'd pull out the hair of their beards, you'd cut off the front of their hair, this hair, short hair in the front, or shave part of your head. That was a sign of humiliation. They may not practice their religion in public. They may not wear any symbols of their religion in public. They do not enjoy the same rights as Muslims. They may not be armed. They may not dress like Muslims. Again, talk about bigotry. They wanted the Dhamai to be identifiable. They were second-class citizens. They wanted them to be identified. This is the scum. These aren't Muslims. You can treat them the way you want to. They may not testify against Muslims. A whole range of other things. They can't even build a structure as high as a Muslim building. It's on and on and on along those ways. Now, why would they do that? Here's the twofold purpose of that. One, obviously, was to fill the Islamic coffers with the jizya tax imposed on the Dhamai, but secondly, it was to grind down the resistance of the non-believers within the society until they finally submitted and accepted Islam. Remember, convert, be enslaved, or die? Okay, this is the type of slavery. Now, you could get out of that if you just became a Muslim. Now, a lot of times when Islam moved into a certain community, the first generation of demise would hold fairly firm. Some would convert right away, others would not. But we usually saw that the kids just got tired of the abuse, tired of the poverty, tired of the discrimination. They said, all this will end if I just become a Muslim. And so they would convert. So oftentimes we see this recurring pattern where Islam moves into an area, usually within 2 to 3 generations. That area is almost completely, like 96, 97% Islamic. It's been very, very effective. Okay, next slide, please. We've looked at some of the basics of Islam. We've looked at briefly at some of the basics of their history. Let's review. Let's see how well I'm doing here in this review. Next slide. Violence, theft, assault, swarming, mutilation, murder, intimidation, extortion, vandalism, vengeance, trafficking in illegal and immoral activities, rituals, territoriality, extreme bigotry toward outsiders, one-way membership. Once you're in, you stay in. By the way, the only thing worse than being a kafir is being what they call a hypocrite or an apostate. That's somebody who was a Muslim and then leaves. That's guaranteed hell and death here on earth. It's an automatic death sentence. And then, of course, authoritative, charismatic, dictatorial leadership. Does that sound pretty comprehensive? Actually, I wasn't describing Islam there. At least that wasn't my basic intent. As I was going through this study, something occurred to me. That sounds an awful lot like. And so I broke away and I did a little study on something else. This is what I found that characterizes a gang. The Bloods, the Crips, La Cosa Nostra, Mafia, MS-13, Yakuza. I studied them. These are the main characteristics of a gang. Does it sound familiar? Next slide, please. Islam is a gang with a god. Think of what gangs do. They give you a sense of identity. You get to be one of us. Not only that, you get to indulge all your most base, crass, carnal, vicious ambitions as long as you do it to the other guys. Sound familiar? Islamic dualism? Muhammad basically said, yeah, go rob, go rape, go torture, go kill. Anything you want to do is okay to those other guys that don't accept us, don't accept Allah. He authorized the indulgence of all those base carnal needs and carnal instincts as long as you do it to the other guys. And he supercharged his gang by adding a god, Allah. Now, basic gang members don't think they're good. They don't think they're doing right. In fact, they take pride in being wrong. But that's always one way you can get to them. Because there's always like a little kernel of goodness in somebody, and you can appeal to that and get them to leave. But Muhammad outsmarted that. He says, no, you get to be good by doing these things. Just do it to the other guys. And so he supercharged his gang. If you want a short definition of Islam, it's a gang with a god. Next slide, please. So how do we respond? I spent 23 years in the classroom, and I mean with my back to the chalkboard, not my face to the chalkboard. I value education. But I'll be the first one to say that education is a great start. It's a horrible finish. You have to do something with your education. If you don't do something with your education, really, I think that's pretty pathetic. Only thing it qualifies you to do is maybe win the next time you play Trivial Pursuit. Maybe you'll get to meet Alex Trebek on Jeopardy and make a few bucks. The purpose of an education is to do something constructive with it. You just got an education here. What are you going to do with it? That's the challenge now. Well, I would say we always have to figure out what is our goal. So if I have the next slide, there's a little inside joke here. When I was in college, you know, I don't know if we have any academics here, but you know, the academics love those big fancy terms. You know, they got to justify being called doctor, right? So I remember this one. They talked about the evaluative criteria. What are the evaluative criteria that were used? Evaluative criteria just means standards for decision making. For example, if you're going to buy a vehicle, what do you get? Well, that depends. You have certain standards for making a decision. If you're a farmer or a construction worker, you'll probably want to get a pickup truck because it's useful to you. If you're a family man, you got 2, 3, 4, 5 kids, you probably consider a van or an SUV. If you think you are some hotshot bachelor, you'll probably consider a sports car. So what are the evaluative criteria we are going to use now to consider how we're going to respond to Islam? I would suggest there are two primary ones that outweigh all the rest. Next slide, please. Number one is this. This is war. This is as real a war as has ever existed that we have ever been involved in. This is as real as the war for independence. This is as real as the Civil War. This is as real as World War I, World War II. Just because religion is mixed in there shouldn't confuse the fact that this is a bloody shooting war, and it has been for 14 centuries. Muhammad declared war 14 centuries ago and has been relentlessly prosecuted ever since. Number two, the only alternative for us kafirs is convert, be enslaved, or die, as we have said. This is a war. Your only options are convert, be enslaved, or die. Next slide, please. Coexist is not an option. It makes for a clever bumper sticker. It makes for horrible policy. It doesn't work because they won't let it work. It's just that simple. So, next slide. What do you think? Now, what we're going to do right now is we're going to pause for just about a minute because we're getting near the end of the presentation. We're very near the end. We're going to pause for a minute. I would ask that nobody talk with anybody else. Don't raise your hand. Don't suggest. I'm not going to ask for anybody to tell me your ideas. For a minute, you're going to have absolute privacy in the sanctity and security of your own mind to mull over what you have just heard and to think for yourself, what should we do? And you're not going to have to worry about anybody throwing tomatoes at you like I have to when I stand up here like this. You don't have to worry about anybody following you home like I have to. You don't have to worry about being politically correct or what your friends might think about you. Just take a minute. And after what you have heard, think, what do you think we need to do? I'll give you about a minute, and then I've got just a few concluding remarks. Okay. Again, I'm not going to ask for anybody to share your opinion. If you want to afterwards, that's fine with me, but I'm not trying to put anybody on the spot. I wouldn't be surprised, though, if some of you may have thought, well, what we need to do is reach out to those moderate Muslims so that we can build some kind of rapport with them, build some bridges, start working with them so that we can collectively, together, go against those extremists. We need to ally with the moderate Muslims. What moderate Muslims? You mean the ones that flocked to the streets to protest after the Twin Towers came down? You mean the ones that protested the violence at Charlie Hebdo? You mean the ones who wrote the letters to the editor and came out protesting all of this violence when San Bernardino was attacked, when Nice was attacked, when Orlando was attacked? Those moderate Muslims? Oh, that's right. There weren't any. Now, I'm not saying that there aren't some out there that are less rabid than the extremists, and the book talks about that. We just don't have time tonight. But here's an example. Dr. Dale Broom over here You want to just wave? He is a member of the Redlands Area Interfaith Council. After the December 2nd attack in our own town here, San Bernardino, he drafted an excellent document that I've had the chance to read. There's several points to it, but basically, if I can summarize, there was two main things. He asked Muslim leaders and Muslims in general to sign this paper to renounce violent jihad and to renounce criminal activity and to say if they were aware of anybody planning any criminal activity, they'd report it. Dr. Broom, how many people, how many Muslim leaders and Muslims in general signed that? None. There's your moderate Muslims. They were offered the chance, and they didn't take it. Next slide, please. There was a chapter in the book near the end called The Myth of the Moderate Muslim. Now, we're going to talk about two different things here, but basically, I'm going to give you my conclusion. Next slide. To build a strategy that is founded upon cooperating with moderate Muslims is as hopeful as building a skyscraper that is founded upon a cumulus cloud. Both are destined to fail and fall. Again, I'm not saying there aren't some that are less rabid, but you know what? Think about how the rules of the game have been defined. When push comes to shove and they don't join in the pushing, that's here, and later, it's hell. Now, I want to talk about two more things real quickly, and we'll wrap up. Next slide, please. I want to talk about the myth of the moderate verses in the Quran and the myth of the friendly Muslim, because this is a part of the Muslim mindset you must also understand. If you walk out this door and you don't hear this part, you are going to be vulnerable to be hoodwinked. Because we hear this all the time. The moderate verses in the Quran. A lot of the Muslims and Muslim leaders will refer to these moderate verses. Next slide, please. And they're there. No question about it. There are verses in the Quran that range from the compassionate and the pacific to the savage and the bellicose. They will quote, oftentimes, the compassionate and the pacific to try to lead you to believe that Islam is a religion of peace. But how do we reconcile these? How do we make sense of this? Here's something you must understand so you won't be fooled. Next slide, please. And that is the concept of abrogation. Fancy word, it means to cancel out. And this is from the Quran. It says, and again, I'll translate, none of our revelations do we abrogate or cause to be forgotten, but we substitute something better or similar. Knowest thou not that Allah hath power over all things? Now, basically, the setting is this. After Muhammad had gone up to Medina, and now he is this warlord, some of his people who had been with him for a while said, hey, Mo, you know, this doesn't sound like what you were saying a few years ago. You know, back then it was all peace and love and nice stuff like that. And now you're getting real violent. How do you reconcile this? Allah took care of his boy once again, provided this convenient divine download. Allah is speaking to me. Basically, how this translates is this. Everything in the Quran is true. It comes from Allah. But Allah is so wonderful that he is capable of giving us even better truths today than he did before. So, whenever one verse in the Quran seems to contradict another, you take the more recent one. And that's what we see in this next slide. The principle of abrogation says that if Quranic verses seem to contradict, you take the more recent one. So, next slide. This means that you must not only pay attention to what the Quran says, but to when it says it. And that's not easy because the surahs are not arranged in chronological order. They're arranged from longest to shortest. Why? I have no idea. So it's hard to figure out, well, which is the more recent ones? But the scholars have figured that out. And that brings us back to one of our favorite verses that we already discussed before. And that is, next slide. It's again a distinction between the Meccan and the Medinan Qurans. They're the same Quran, but there's very different spirits. But that verse that we have to come back to is, next slide, our favorite verse of the sword, 9:5. I'll shorten it a little bit. Then when the sacred months are drawn away, slay the idolaters wherever you find them, and take them and confine them, and lie in wait for them at every place of ambush. Most scholars believe that the ninth surah is one of the last and perhaps the last surah ever written down or ever revealed to Muhammad. He didn't write them down. Ever revealed to him, which means number nine has the potential to abrogate or cancel out everything else. Theoretically, if nine said something that was contrary to the whole rest of the 113 other surahs, this one's the one you'd have to take because it's probably the last one. Next slide, please. The ninth surah says probably one of the, probably the last. And the verse of the sword alone has been figured by scholars to abrogate at least 124 more tolerant and peaceful verses. Next slide, please. As many as 225 Quranic verses are overridden or altered by later verses. And for the most part, what you find is all those compassionate and pacific verses are replaced by the savage and the bellicose ones. So, next slide. The imams and the mullahs can honestly tell you that those moderate verses are in the Quran. They just can't honestly tell you that they matter. They have been abrogated. They have been canceled out. They are a propaganda tool now used specifically to fool you, to lull you into a false sense of security. They don't matter. So much for the moderate verses. Let's go on to the myth of the friendly Muslim. Next slide, please. A lot of people, including myself, probably many of you, maybe all of you, know some Muslim families or some Muslims. Oh, yeah, they're really nice people. I've got some live down the street from me. I work with some. My kid goes to school with some. Really good people. You know, I've broken bread with them, as I've had the chance, about, what, 2 weeks ago. Really nice people. It's great. I can't believe this about them. Can't believe this about them. No, no, no. Well, let's take a look at this. And it's pretty clear cut and it's pretty simple. Next slide, please. Muslims are not allowed to have non-Muslim friends, period. Period. You cannot. Their sacred writings, as well as the teachings of Muhammad, prohibit it. There are roughly a dozen verses in the Quran which affirm that Muslims cannot and must not have friends among the kafirs. And just to prove that, let's look at a few. Next slide, please. This is from the Quran 5:51. O believers, take not Jews and Christians as friends. They are friends of each other. Whoso of you makes them his friend is one of them. God guides not the people of evildoers. Remember, God does not love the unbeliever. The unbeliever goes to hell. We are unbelievers. What does it say here? You're one of them if you make them your friends. So if you Muslims make a kafir your friend when you're Christians or a Jew, what are you? You're going to hell. Do you think a Muslim is going to risk going to hell to have you as a friend? Next slide, please. O believers, take not my enemy. This is Allah speaking. Notice this is from the Quran, so this is Allah speaking. Take not my enemy and your enemy for friends, offering them love, though they have disbelieved in the truth that has come to you. I know very well what you conceal and what you publish, and whosoever of you does that has gone astray from the right way. Now, let's pull this apart a little bit and see just how powerful this is. First of all, again, Allah is saying the non-believers are enemies of His. If you take them as your friends, you become one of them. Now, here's the other scary little thing. It says, I know very well what you conceal and what you publish. Allah is saying, I know what's going on in your head and your heart. Now, this cuts both ways. What He's saying is, and if you're a Muslim and you're in a small minority, like in the United States, it's okay for you to act like a friend to them because I know what's in your heart. I know you're just faking them out. That's okay. So you can act like a friend and you won't get in any trouble as long as you don't really regard them as a friend. But the other side of that blade is this one. If you have any warm, fuzzy feelings for them, I know that too. And you've just become one of them. And you're going to hell. And if that isn't clear enough, let's look at the next slide. And whosoever takes them for friends, those they are evildoers. If you Muslims take a kafir as a friend, you're as bad as they are, you're an evildoer, and again, you're going to hell. Do you really think a Muslim is going to risk going to hell, burning there in the hellfire that the Muhammad talked about so many times, just so you can be his friend? Not likely. So, next slide. Regarding your Muslim friends, well, either they aren't very good Muslims or they aren't very good friends. But that's okay, because it's okay to lie to kafirs. And Allah will know if you're lying and for what reason. If you're faking them out in order to set them up for later on, it's okay. Remember taqiyah, sacred deception, and kitman, partial truth. So, next slide, please. Again, having kind of hopefully swept aside that notion of the moderate myths in the Quran and the moderate Muslims, let's get back to that question I posed a few minutes ago. How do we respond? Next slide, please. Well, again, if this is a war, and if the only options for us are to convert, be enslaved, or die, and we choose none of these, then, next slide, I don't see any other option. Realistically, I don't see any other option. Next slide. How? At this point, I hate to seem like a tease, but in the book, I have some very specific options for domestic and foreign policy. Very specific. Not, well, we've got to fight back. I'm going to tell you specifically what needs to be done. However, for the purpose of this meeting, one of the rules of engagement, we might say, was that I'm not going to go into them. The reasons, and if I'm not representing this fairly, please let me know. The reasons were, one, they are political. They're not partisan. It's not Republican or Democrat. In fact, it's very different from anything they're offering. And I'll tell you one thing. These recommendations will make Donald Trump look like a wimp. They are brass knucks, hardcore, given the reality we're facing. The other thing about them is, because of that, they are kind of distasteful. And I've said as much. The first time I gave this presentation was to a Calvary chapel in Diamond Bar, and I was allowed to go into the discussion there, and I started by saying, this stuff is distasteful, and I hope you find it distasteful. If you don't find this distasteful, there's something wrong with you. But a lot of the stuff in the Old Testament is pretty distasteful, wasn't it? A lot of the things we've had to do throughout our history is pretty distasteful, right? But I understand completely. So, unfortunately, I'd be happy to give you the punchline, but I've agreed not to. So what that means is you've got basically two options. You can buy the book and read it yourself, but I'm not trying to sell books. In fact, if you are interested in the book, I'm giving a home church discount. They're basically $15 plus tax. If you want it, you can get it for $10. I'd give them away, but they cost me some stuff too. Invite me to a meeting at your house or among your friends or at your church or your organization. I'll go through the whole thing. I'll go through what I just did. I don't charge anything. Or we can go out and, you know, go to Coco's and have a piece of pie and, you know, a drink or something like that, and I'll tell you exactly what they are. But these are part of what I agreed to, and I do what I agreed to. So, at this point, I will say this, though. The recommendations that I make are very hardcore. I was in the United States Marine Corps. I know what fighting is about. I know what war is about. I know what you have to do when you get in that situation. You hope and pray and do everything you can to avoid that situation, but sometimes you can't. And when you can't, you gotta do what you gotta do. But I will say this also. Built into each of these proposals on domestic policy and foreign policy is a humanitarian escape hatch. You see, I believe that a great many, and possibly even a strong majority of Muslims, would love to get out, but they can't. You're an apostate. You're a hypocrite. Automatic death sentence. We saw this right after Muhammad died. There was the beginning of a mass exodus from Islam, but it was brutally squashed, crushed by his immediate successor, Abu Bakr. More recently, in 2009, we saw an uprising in Iran, of all places. But it, too, was brutally crushed, and nobody outside came to the assistance. What if we could, through this proposal, these proposals of mine, give the Muslims an escape hatch? There's definitely a stick aspect to my proposals. There's also definitely a carrot aspect. Leave Islam, or at least, you know, create, if you don't have to become a Christian, I'd rather you would, but give up the violence. If you want to say your prayers five times a day and all this other stuff, okay. But again, this is no longer Islam. You can't take, like I said, you can't take the violence out of Islam anymore than you can take the wet out of water. What if we could be a part of saving hundreds of millions of Muslims around the world? Wouldn't that be fantastic? In fact, wouldn't it be humanitarian, compassionate, and Christian? That is really what I'm after. In World War II, my dad answered the call of his age to fight one of the most brutal tyrannies that enslaved millions of people. He undertook flight training and became a B-24 pilot. He flew in the European theater. He flew 18 missions before he was shot down. That plane was called the B-24, its nickname, the Liberator. I believe now that we need to once again answer the call to fight against this tyranny that has killed 270 million people and counting and enslaved tens and tens and tens of millions more. We need another liberator. And I'm willing to do my part. And I hope you'll be willing to do your part. So, at this point, I want to thank you for being here, for sticking it out on a very unpleasant topic. If it's okay, I'll answer questions except those questions. But if you have some questions, I'll do the best I can. But I can't tell you about the recommendations, but maybe in another venue we can do that, okay? So, any kind of questions or anything? I know that very well. It's the Marine hymn, being a Marine, from the halls of Montezuma to the shores of Tripoli. Tripoli was the first war the United States was involved in after the American Revolution. In 1785, this is 2 years after the Revolution was over and 2 years before the Constitution was even written, American ships like the USS Philadelphia were attacked off the Barbary Coast, the north coast of Africa in the Mediterranean. They were the Barbary pirates. These were Muslims. And Americans were captured and held for ransom by the American government, paid by the American government, and some were sold into slavery. And it wasn't until years later that finally Thomas Jefferson authorized, and part of it was we just weren't strong enough. We didn't have much of a navy. We didn't have much of a fighting force. Finally, Thomas Jefferson authorized a contingent of naval vessels and their marine detachments to go over and kick them around a little bit. And we did. In fact, the Marine's officer's sword is the Mameluke sword. It was presented by one of the leaders there who was so grateful that we helped to reestablish his authority that he presented this sword, the Mameluke sword, and we Marine officers still carry that sword. So yes, that was the first fight we had outside of the Revolution, and that's from the Marine Corps hymn. Yes?
I didn't find anything, but it was the Baha'is. It was Jack. Oh. Getting crazy with his Baha'is.
Uh-huh,